creating independent stimuli for dreaming. Among the superior activities which, even on sober comparison, one is tempted to ascribe to the dream life, memory is the most striking. We have fully discussed the frequent experiences which prove this fact. Another superiority of the dream life, frequently extolled by the old authors, viz., that it can regard itself supreme in reference to distance of time and space, can be readily recognized as an illusion. This superiority, as observed by Hildebrandt, is only illusional. The dream takes as much heed of time and space as the waking thought, and this because it is only a form of thinking. The dream is supposed to enjoy still another advantage in reference to time, that is, it is independent in still another sense of the passage of time. Dreams like the guillotine dream of Maury, reported above, seem to show that the dream can crowd together more perception content in a very short space of time than can be controlled by our psychic activity in the waking mind. These conclusions have been controverted, however, by many arguments. The essays of Le Lorrain and Egger, concerning the apparent duration of dreams, gave rise to a long and interesting discussion, which has probably not said the last word upon this delicate and far-reaching question. That the dream has the ability to take up the intellectual work of the day and bring to a conclusion what has not been settled during the day, that it can solve doubt and problems, and that it may become the source of new inspiration in poets and composers, seems to be indisputable, as is shown by many reports and by the collection compiled by Chabanet. But even if there be no dispute as to the facts, nevertheless their interpretation is open in principle to a great many doubts. Finally, the asserted divinatory power of the dream forms an object of contention in which hard, unsurmountable reflection encounters obstinate and continued faith. It is indeed just that we should refrain from denying all that is based on fact in this subject, as there is a possibility that a number of such cases may perhaps be explained on a natural psychological basis. F. The ethical feelings in the dream. For reasons which will be understood only after cognizance has been taken of my own investigations of the dream, I have separated from the psychology of the dream the partial problem whether and to what extent the moral dispositions and feelings of the waking life extend into the dreams. The same contradictions which we were surprised to observe in the author's descriptions of all the other psychic capacities strike us again here. Some affirm decidedly that the dream knows nothing of moral obligations. Others, as decidedly, that the moral nature of man remains even in his dream life. A reference to our dream experience of every night seems to raise the correctness of the first assertion beyond doubt. Jessen says, page 553, "Nor does one become better or more virtuous in the dream. On the contrary, it seems that conscience is silent in the dream, inasmuch as one feels no compassion and can commit the worst crimes, such as theft, murder, and assassination, with perfect indifference and without subsequent remorse." Radstock, page 146, says, "It is to be noticed that in the dream the associations terminate and the ideas unite without being influenced by reflection and reason, aesthetic taste and moral judgment. The judgment is extremely weak, and ethical indifference reigns supreme." Volkelt, page 23, expresses himself as follows. "As everyone knows, the sexual relationship in the dream is especially unbridled. Just as the dreamer himself is shameless in the extreme, and wholly lacking moral feeling and judgment, so also he sees others, even the most honored persons, engaged in actions which even in thought he would blush to associate with them in his waking state." Utterances like those of Schopenhauer, that in the dream every person acts and talks in accordance with his character, form the sharpest contrast to those mentioned above. R.P. Fisher maintains that the subjective feelings and desires or affects and passions manifest themselves in the willfulness of the dream life, and that the moral characteristics of a person are mirrored in his dream. Hafner, page 25, "With rare exceptions, a virtuous person will be virtuous also in his dreams. He will resist temptation and show no sympathy for hatred, envy, anger, and all other vices, while the sinful person will, as a rule, also find in his dreams the pictures which he has before him while awake." Scholz, page 36, "In the dream there is truth. Despite all masking in pride or humility, we still recognize our own self. The honest man does not commit any dishonourable offence, even in the dream, or if this does occur, he is terrified over it, as if over something foreign to his nature. The Roman emperor, who ordered one of his subjects to be executed because he dreamed that he cut off the emperor's head, was not wrong in justifying his action on the ground that he who has such dreams must have similar thoughts while awake. About a thing that can have no place in our mind, we therefore say significantly, "I would never dream of such a thing." Plaff, varying a familiar proverb, says, "Tell me for a time your dreams, and I will tell you what you are within." The short work of Hildebrandt, from which I have already taken so many quotations, a contribution to the dream problem as complete and as rich in thought as I found in the literature, places the problem of morality in the dream as the central point of its interest. For Hildebrandt, too, it is a strict rule that the purer the life, the purer the dream, the impurer the former, the impurer the latter. The moral nature of man remains even in the dream. But while we are not offended nor made suspicious by an arithmetical error no matter how obvious, by a reversal of science no matter how romantic, or by an anachronism no matter how witty, we nevertheless do not lose sight of the difference between good and evil, right and wrong, virtue and vice. No matter how much of what follows us during the day may vanish in our hours of sleep, Kant's categorical imperative sticks to our heels as an inseparable companion from whom we cannot rid ourselves even in slumber. This can be explained, however, only by the fact that the fundamental in human nature, the moral essence, is too firmly fixed to take part in the activity of the kaleidoscopic shaking up to which fantasy, reason, memory, and other faculties of the same rank succumb in the dream, page 45, etc. In the further discussion of the subject, we find remarkable distortion and inconsequence in both groups of authors. Strictly speaking,